Chapter 16. Mr. Bagthorpe's prophecies about Great Aunt Lucy turned out to be almost uncannily accurate. Nearly everybody heard, with misgivings, her first word on arrival at Unicorn House. The hall clock was just striking noon. She held up a hand, forestalling Mrs. Bagthorpe's effusive welcome. "Ah," she exclaimed, "the stroke of 12." She heard the chimes out, and made everyone else do the same, before saying with satisfaction, "There's something so rounded about the stroke of 12, I always feel. Don't you?" Nobody knew what to say to this except Grandma. "I find it a quite undistinguished hour," she said. "So far as I am concerned, one hour is much the same as another. Are you sure you are quite recovered, Lucy? You are still pale, though that may be, of course, the shade of your powder." Great Aunt Lucy did not hear any of this because she was fishing, with the hand that was not holding her stick, into her pocket. "Ah!" She drew out a large and ancient timepiece. This she consulted, and instantly exclaimed, "But the clock is wrong. There are still 2 minutes before 12." "You are mistaken, Lucy," said Grandma calmly. "That clock was a wedding present from myself to Henry and Laura, and keeps perfect time. It has never lost a minute in 18 years." "But my own timepiece is accurate to within fractions of a second." Great Aunt Lucy was already becoming agitated. The bees were buzzing ominously. "I have had it overhauled by a master clockmaker. Quickly, turn on the radio. We must check." "Jack, switch on the portable in the kitchen," his mother told him. "I can't," he said. "All the radios are in the garden, remember, playing Radio 3 to Tess's seeds." He knew this for a fact. He would not part with his own transistor from Monday to Friday until he had heard Terry Wogan, his favorite disc jockey. When he had taken it out that morning, just after 10, the vegetable garden had already been in full concert, with radios and tape recorders everywhere. He remembered glancing over to the meadow beyond, with its giant oak and beech trees, and wondering how they had got to be that size without the benefit of music. He had actually voiced this thought to Tess, who had said witheringly, "Yes, and look how long it's taken them. Centuries. My own seedlings are already through within the week." Jack thought the analogy between radishes and oaks an unfair one, but did not say so. He rarely entered into argument with any of his siblings, because they were so much cleverer than he. At this point, Mr. Bagthorpe, surprisingly, ordered, "You go and get that transistor and put it back where it belongs. This benighted country could be overrun by Martians, and we'd never know, for all the news we ever get to hear these days." Jack went. His father really was very difficult to understand. Mr. Bagthorpe hardly ever listened to or read the news. He did not care for it, he said. Even Jack could see that he got politicians hopelessly mixed up, and was always confusing presidents of different countries, and even the countries themselves. Jack would not have been so surprised by his father's apparent change of heart had he been present in the car during the drive back from the hospital. Great Aunt Lucy had been so genuinely effusive in her thanks to Mr. Bagthorpe for restoring her belief in time that he had been impressed, despite himself. "Just think, Henry, if you had not placed that bag of mushrooms for me to trip over, none of this would ever have happened." "That's true, I suppose," he agreed. "And I shall be eternally grateful, Henry," she continued. "I shall never forget who was the instrument of my newfound happiness." All this sounded very promising. Mr. Bagthorpe had every reason to be wary of any apparent changes of heart in this particular relative, but she had, he reflected, already been converted to time for nearly 3 weeks. This phase was apparently ticking over very nicely, and given her obvious gratitude to himself, it now seemed that he could again be with a chance in the inheritance stakes. It would do no harm, he decided, to humor her for the remainder of her stay. Nonetheless, he was to find this as trying as did the rest of the family. His aunt's conversation was tedious to a degree, being confined almost entirely to time checks, and there were frequent altercations with Grandma, whose own sense of time now seemed to have slipped badly. She was late for every meal, and on one occasion almost succeeded in destroying at a single blow Aunt Lucy's newly discovered confidence in time. She telephoned the speaking clock, with the radio beside her giving a time check, and triumphantly reported that either the BBC or the GPO was 3 seconds out. Whether or not this was true, nobody knew. The immediate outcome was that Great Aunt Lucy herself took to telephoning the speaking clock on the hour, with the radio beside her. Every now and then she would ring between hours, to catch it off guard, as it were. Mr. Bagthorpe was enraged by this practice, and laid the blame for it squarely at Grandma's door. "When that telephone bill arrives," he told her, "you will foot it, and you may even find yourself paying for my having a nervous breakdown. It now feels to me as if there are many more than 24 hours in a day. My whole body and brain rhythms have been overturned. I am suffering from chronic jet lag." The rest of the Bagthorpes were irritated by Great Aunt Lucy, but not beyond endurance. They comforted themselves with the prospect of the Parker banquet on the horizon, this to be followed by the departure of their guest to Torquay, where she would doubtless embark on the lifelong work of having all her haywire timepieces thoroughly overhauled and tested. Tess was the sole member of the family really interested in Great Aunt Lucy's revised world view. The only trouble was, she was constantly trying to make the old lady revert to her former stance. "There is no such thing as time," she insisted. A lot of the books she was currently reading advanced this theory. Jack sometimes worried about her. The experiments she was making were becoming increasingly bizarre. She had recently, for instance, mounted in a corner of her salad patch an experiment involving cardboard pyramids, razor blades, and dead mice. Any razor left under a pyramid shape would sharpen itself automatically, she claimed. The dead mouse under the cardboard pyramid would not decay, she said, whereas the one under an ordinary empty carton certainly would. "In a week's time I shall remove the coverings and we shall see," she told everybody. "The pyramid shape has extraordinary powers, as the ancient Egyptians were well aware." "So if we all built ourselves pyramid-shaped houses and stopped inside them all our lives, we'd all be immortal, I suppose?" inquired William sarcastically. "Very probably," she replied coolly, "if, of course, there was any such thing as time." There really did seem every danger of Tess exchanging strings to her bow for bees in her bonnet. When the day of the banquet arrived, the younger Bagthorpes, at least, prepared themselves in a state of pleasurable anticipation. They all put on their best things, and Grandma and Great-Aunt Lucy were so bejeweled and ornamented in their effort to outdo one another that they would have appeared overdressed even at a coronation. Mrs. Fosdick had on her best turquoise crepe, and bore 2 covered baskets containing quantities of stuffed eggs. She was, though she would not have admitted this, pleased at the prospect of overseeing a firm of London caterers, and even allowed Grandpa to sample a couple of eggs in advance. These, judging by his reactions, were well up to standard. The first hint of a cloud on the horizon came when Grandma requested Jack to go up to her room and fetch the cat basket. "Cat basket?" repeated Mr. Bagthorpe sharply, overhearing this. "Why in the devil's name do we require a cat basket?" "Because there is no question of a banquet without the presence of Thomas the Second," she replied. She had ceased referring to the kitten as Little Tommy immediately after his change in ownership, understandably feeling that this title did not command respect. "If that cat goes," her son told her, "then I don't." "That is entirely up to you, Henry," she told him calmly. "He received a special invitation this morning from Daisy herself. As this banquet is in her honor, I would not dream of disappointing her." Mrs. Bagthorpe here smoothly interposed in an effort to extract her husband from a seeming impasse, without loss of face. "Do hurry up and fetch the basket, Jack. It shall travel in my car. Father, mother, Jack, and Rosie, you will travel with myself." At this, Mr. Bagthorpe stamped out muttering, followed by his own allocation of passengers, and the confrontation was thus resolved. Jack himself could not help feeling that the respite was only temporary. Judging by the hissings and scratchings from inside the basket he went to fetch, Thomas the Second had been trained up with great effectiveness. Also, he alone, besides Great Aunt Lucy, knew that a similar basket, containing the formidable Wong Fu, was already reposing on the back seat of Mr. Bagthorpe's car. He had been given a pound note for putting it there.